From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Martinez.
Hercules. I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, a controversial oyster farm in Point Reyes causes us to consider the best way for humans to interact with nature.
More and more, I think people don't want to see the sort of black and white wilderness versus non-wilderness. In a way, I think we've almost evolved beyond that.
We'll look into efforts to tap into the ocean to solve California's water woes.
I think that first we really need to work on improving the efficiency of our current water use before we start moving towards very expensive, energy-intensive sources of water.
And we'll consider another serious problem you probably didn't even think the ocean had.
Right now, layers of low-oxygen water are expanding upwards all along the California coast.
What all this means for our water systems today on Cross Currents. Earlier this week, a federal court decided that the Drake's Bay Oyster Company can stay open for now. Late last year, the government ordered the controversial farm to close so that Drake's Estero, where the company operates, could become the first fully protected marine wilderness in the continental United States. But the owners sued, and the case has been in the courts ever since. On Monday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals granted the farm a temporary injunction. The farm won't close yet, but the controversy is far from settled. KALW's Casey Miner and producer Ray Sue Sussman went to Drake's Bay to delve into the bigger philosophical questions that this case asks us to consider about how we want to interact with wilderness and how we can protect it from ourselves. Here's Casey.
Heading north out of San Francisco in a car, it doesn't take long to leave the city behind. You'll drive through the dense urban landscape of the Richmond and cross the Golden Gate Bridge, taking the 101 freeway north. You'll exit and slow down to meander through the woodsy suburbs and cutesy main streets on Sir Francis Drake. The road will get rougher, the buildings fewer and further apart. The hills will take over the landscape, then the redwood trees, until you feel like the metropolis is a million miles away. This is the route to Point Reyes, or more accurately, the Point Reyes National Seashore. We'll stop here a minute. Point Reyes is run by the National Park Service, and it includes a federally protected wilderness area. The government defines a wilderness as
an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain.
Point Reyes is filled with visitors, over 2 million of them each year. They contribute $85 million a year to the region's economy through things like camping fees, kayak rentals, and stopping in at local businesses. For the most part, the relationship between Point Reyes and its visitors is mutually beneficial. But there's also a tension between preserving a natural area for its own sake and encouraging people to interact with it. To see this tension playing out, we'll have to continue on our journey and head to the seashore's northwestern edge, to Drake's Estero and the Drake's Bay Oyster Company. This doesn't look like the site of a battle. It's a small shack at the end of a windy road, the ground scattered with shells. People sit at picnic tables, eating baskets of fresh oysters and looking out over Drake's Estero, a saltwater estuary that's home to thousands of birds, fish, and harbor seals. It feels quiet, even when there are a lot of people around, which lately there have been.
We're loving it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good luck with everything.
Thank you, guys.
Drake's Bay Oyster Company has always been popular. The owners say it provides over a third of the state's oysters, and that's in addition to the lunchtime crowds here. But since late December, customers have wandered in with a little more purpose.
I mean, I think of myself as usually on the Save the Seals team, but this feels different, and it does feel like it's impacting the community.
Nadia Yavorsky is sitting at one of the tables on this overcast day, not long after the business got word that it would have to close.
That's something that we are happy to be a part of and something we're sad to see go. I mean, they're calling themselves a sustainable farm, and I've always seen it that way. It doesn't feel like it has a negative impact on the environment from what I've seen here.
The oyster company is located in what's known as a potential wilderness area within the seashore. 40 years ago, the government granted the company a special lease to continue operating, but that lease expired in late 2012. The farm's owners sued the government, and the case is still going through the courts. But the government maintains that it's time to turn this potential wilderness into a fully protected one.
No one cares more deeply about this ecosystem than we do. I was born and raised on the ranch next door.
This is Kevin Lunny. His family's owned the Drake's Bay Oyster Farm since 2005. The way he sees it, the farm is as integral to Marin's ecosystems, both human and natural, as the birds and the harbor seals.
The people that are opposing us, it's a very few, very extreme wilderness activists. They're not environmentalists. They represent a very, very small, loud, well-funded, well-organized group that is in favor of hands-off preservation, a human-less landscape, and they can't tolerate a working landscape in a place like this.
You know, I'm pretty new to West Marin, but people have been telling me for the past couple of years that there's not been a fight like this in well over three decades.
10 miles away in Point Reyes Station is Amy Traynor's office. Traynor chairs the Environmental Action Committee of West Marin. It's one of the groups that pushed hardest for the oyster farm's closure. Behind her desk is a framed poster showing an aerial photo of Point Reyes in the Estero.
And it's this vibrant colors of aquamarine and green and blue. And there's a really sweet horizon line out at the edge of the ocean. And so when you look at this photo, you really kind of get how magical and really amazing and special this place is and why Congress chose to protect it as wilderness.
Point Reyes has long had elements of both Kevin Lunny's working landscape and Amy Traynor's wilderness. There are historic working ranches throughout the park area, including right next to Drake's Estero. There are also elk preserves and redwood groves near the Estero, areas that people visit but ultimately leave. And then there are the areas that have transitioned from one use to the other, like the Giacomini wetlands, just a block away from Traynor's office.
It's almost 600 acres of restored wetlands, and you can see there's a bunch of ducks and migrating birds. We have kites and hawks, and we have a pair of bald eagles that have been hanging around the past month.
This whole area used to be a dairy ranch. It's actually named for the ranching family. And Traynor says it's a perfect example of what Drake's Estero could become.
It's just really special to be able to come out and have access to this pristine area that's been restored that's so close to town.
A pristine Drake's Estero would be hard to see. A lot of the ecosystem is underwater. If the oyster company closed, it might look much the same. But Traynor and other activists say it would be very different because the human influence would be gone. But can that influence ever fully disappear? That's what Valerio Salgado wonders.
We see places like in Canada, places where even you don't see anything for miles and miles and miles. Here, you find cows. What that means, there is a person feeding. You find a raccoon killed by a car. Many things.
Salgado works at Drake's Bay. He's one of about 30 people who will have to find new jobs if the farm closes. He and his wife have worked on farms in the area for more than two decades. Sitting and eating his lunch with her at one of the picnic tables, he theorizes about what they might do if Drake's Bay closes.
We are willing to take the first job we can perform. So, as I tell you, I will try driver, and as she said, maybe working in a hotel or a job she can perform.
What will happen to workers like Salgado has been a big question, both for the farm's owners and for local environmental groups. Farm advocates say there's no sense in shutting down a lucrative local food business and putting people out of work. Amy Traynor takes issue with that characterization.
There's no question everybody supports local, sustainable, you know, food operations and agricultural production. But that's not the issue here.
For one thing, she says the Lunnies always knew the farm's lease would expire and that they should have planned better for its closure. She also says the oyster company's not sustainable, that it actually harms the environment. Of course, the oyster farm and its supporters refute those claims. And let's just say there has been a lot of back and forth over this question for years. Scientists and government agencies have done studies, released reports, found flaws in those reports. Both sides have accused each other of bad science. In the end, though, the government didn't base its decision to close Drake's Bay on science. It based it on a principle. Here's Traynor.
One is that I think we're really blessed out in West Marin that we can have it all. I also think that, you know, we have to just say no sometimes. You know, there are places where nature absolutely has a right and should just exist in its own right. And if we start compromising our very special places, then it's a really slippery slope.
This, Trainer says, is what the federal definition of wilderness really means. It shouldn't matter whether a particular business is sustainable or unsustainable, good for the local economy or not. It's still a business, and it doesn't belong in a place called a wilderness. Trainer says deciding anything else undermines the whole idea of preserving public land.
We can't have commercial activities in our wilderness lands. I think that would change their character too much.
Janie Hine is executive director for Law, Energy, and the Environment at UC Berkeley's Bolt School of Law. And in full disclosure, a few years ago, Hine worked on a legal team that represented the oyster company pro bono. She says a law like the Wilderness Act, which is what protects Point Reyes, is unique and critical, but it can also have unintended consequences.
It's really trying to look for untrammeled areas or pristine areas of wilderness, which maintain their wilderness character even now. But the irony there is that can, you know, frequently put high wilderness value on areas that are simply hard to reach, like the very top of a mountain peak or a very sparsely populated area.
In other words, places where people can't go. She says at a time when habitats are shrinking and we need to convince people to care about nature, we might want to seek a third way, a way that doesn't see humans and wilderness as incompatible.
More and more, I think people don't want to see the sort of black and white wilderness versus non-wilderness. In a way, I think we've almost evolved beyond that. And I think it's time for creative approaches to think about how can we both incentivize and protect the development of our local sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture, but at the same time preserve these wild areas for future generations.
An example of how this could work is just up the road from the Oyster Company at the Rogers Ranch. It's one of the historic cattle ranches that are all over Point Reyes. Now, the ranchland was never meant to be wilderness. It was created as a pastoral zone and always intended to be working land, nestled in between wilderness and local towns. On a sunny day, Domingo Rogers is finishing up a welding project.
This used to be my ranch, but I retired and my nephew has it now. I just stop here once in a while when I need to use some of the equipment in the shop.
Rogers is 63. He grew up here and he loves it. Looking out across the ranch, he can name all the plants he sees and the birds flying by. He spent his life both admiring the land and running a business on it. And he says he thinks it's possible for them to coexist.
Why can't you have businesses and people and still have the wildlife? I mean, it's not like they're hurting wildlife. The wildlife is here. It's been here. Been here for years.
When you're in Point Reyes, there's no denying that Rogers is right. There's wildlife everywhere. That's why we like to go there. And in some ways, that's what this whole controversy is about. If the Oyster Company leaves Drake's Estero, the Bay Area would gain a truly unique space, the only marine wilderness in the continental U.S. In a world with more people, more cars, more noise, that's increasingly precious. But it's also possible that this place could never be a true wilderness again. In the 50 years since Congress passed the Wilderness Act, our idea of wilderness has changed. It's still somewhere you can seek solace or personal challenge, but it's also somewhere you can drive to, bring your iPhone, maybe your dog. The case of Drake's Bay Oyster Company is just one example of a question we'll face over and over again: how to preserve a wilderness for visitors while fully considering the footprints we'll leave behind. For Cross Currents, I'm Casey Miner.
That story was co-produced by KALW's Ray Sue Sussman. And we want to know what you think about the Drake's Bay case, and also what wilderness means to you. You can share your thoughts at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave a message is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your perspective on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for a dose of brain vitamin, in which we take on scientific quandaries with the best minds in the Bay Area.
Improved learning ability and academic performance, short-term and long-term memory, can be systematically developed in any student of any age.
Deep inside our brain is something rather like the brain of a crocodile.
Have you ever wondered why there's a water shortage in California when we're sitting next to the biggest ocean in the world? Well, it's full of salt water, of course, but there are ways to get that salt out. It's called desalination. There are currently 19 desalination facilities planned to serve Californians, including two in Mexico. But there are some potential problems with the desalination solution. For today's Brain Vitamin, KALW's Roman Mars spoke with Heather Cooley, co-director of the water program at the Pacific Institute.
California has always had its water problems. It's Chinatown. But increasingly, we're looking west to the Pacific Ocean to help quench our thirst. And since we are in a seemingly perpetual drought and have a lot of coastline, it appears to be the perfect solution. Well, that's settled. Technology will save us. Turns out, it's not that easy. Never is. First, let's back up. How do you do it? How do you remove salt from water? I asked Heather Cooley, a senior research associate with the Pacific Institute in Oakland, to help me understand. When it comes to desalination, there are two basic methods. There's the simple way, the way you get fresh water if you were trapped on a desert island.
Essentially, you heat the water and collect the water vapor and then recondense that vapor to form fresh water. And that leaves the salt on one side and then the fresh water separate.
Presumably on the desert island, you'd use coconut shells. And then there's the increasingly more common industrial method known as reverse osmosis.
With reverse osmosis, you essentially use pressure to force the seawater through a membrane. And that membrane then separates the salt from the fresh water. There's generally about a 50% recovery. So what that means is if you have 100 gallons of water that you then push through the membrane, you get 50 gallons of fresh water and about 50 gallons of saltier brine.
Basically, the price of energy and the scarcity of fresh water, which raises the demand and price of water, are both increasing. So it's hard to predict that magic point where the two lines intersect and desalination becomes an economical solution. In the Middle East, where water is very rare and energy is very cheap, it makes sense to desalinate. In California, it might not for quite some time. But there's another cost, the environment.
There are two ways to take water into a desalination plant, and one is through an open ocean intake, where essentially it's a pipeline that extends out to the ocean and a pump. And then there's also subsurface wells. Subsurface wells where I dig a hole in the sand and they essentially take and extract the water through the sand. The open ocean intakes cause more environmental harm or can cause more environmental harm because any of the small marine organisms are killed on the intake stream or are either taken into the plant and then killed in the desalination process. They're essentially trapped on the membrane or killed during the pretreatment. Subsurface wells are a better alternative, assuming that building the wells doesn't disturb the environment too much. But with subsurface wells, you're using sand as a natural filter. So because of that, the marine organisms are not taken in or killed on the screen. But the byproduct of seawater desalination is a salty brine that must be disposed of. And that salty brine contains not only salt, but chemicals used throughout the desalination plant. That brine typically is just discharged straight back into the ocean, where it can pose a threat to marine organisms, particularly those that lie on the bottom.
So it's clear that desalination is not going to be the perfect cure to all of our water woes, but pressure due to population increase, drought, and regional scarcity will only lead to more talk of desalination, and we'll just have to redo the numbers each step of the way. In California, the more promising solution is a lot less sexy than technology saving the day, and that's boring old conservation. These days, we like to jazz it up by calling it efficiency.
A large fraction of the water that we use on our lawns and to wash our cars and things of that nature, things that don't require high-quality potable water. I think that first we really need to work on improving the efficiency of our current water use before we start moving towards very expensive, energy-intensive sources of water.
With a Brain Vitamin, I'm Roman Mars for CrossCurrents.
And to find more information on our oceans, next week San Francisco is hosting the 10th International Ocean Film Festival. We'll put a link to that at our website. It's kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. When we talk about climate change, it's easy to get stuck in our terrestrial mammal mindset. Let's face it, most of us are total dry land chauvinists. The only time many of us even notice something's happening to the ocean is when it's gnawing away at our coastline. But something else is going on just beneath the surface. Certain sections of the ocean are losing oxygen. And that's just as bad for sea creatures as it would be for us. Science commentator Max McClure explains.
Slow suffocation can be a real drag on productivity. If you've ever been continually strangled for a whole workday, you know what I'm talking about. Your boss is all, "Can you give me a progress update?" And you're all gurgle, gurgle, frantic hand gesture. It's easy to forget, but this is true for marine organisms as well. Even fish need to breathe. If a fish that's used to swimming in an oxygen-rich environment is engulfed by a wave of low oxygen water, it had better escape fast. Otherwise, it might end up, forgive me, sleeping with the fishes. This situation isn't hypothetical. Right now, layers of low oxygen water are expanding upwards all along the California coast. See, we tend to think of the ocean as a big basin of water. But to understand what's going on here, it might be more helpful to look at it as an enormous parfait. It's actually made up of three distinct layers that behave in very different ways. At the surface, oxygen abounds. The water's choppy and turbulent, and air gets continuously whipped in. The surface is also well-lit, so free-floating algae can add more oxygen to the mix through photosynthesis. That surface layer is by far the most productive and densely populated neighborhood in the open ocean. Counterintuitively, there's also a lot of oxygen at the very bottom of the sea. When ocean currents carry surface water from the tropics up to the poles, that water gets cold, which means it gets dense. It drops to the seafloor and oozes back out across the bottom of the ocean. But in between, in the midwater, things get more complicated. Vast populations of marine bacteria survive on organic matter sinking from the surface. They use up a lot of oxygen just by breathing. But because there's little or no light, they don't photosynthesize, which means there's no way to replace that oxygen. This middle layer is called the oxygen minimum zone, or OMZ. As it happens, we have the world's largest OMZ right on our doorstep, along the eastern edge of the Pacific. And it's getting bigger. Here on the west coast, the upper edge is about 100 meters closer to the surface than it was 50 years ago. Climate change models predict this. As the ocean's surface layer heats up, it becomes less dense, meaning it mixes even less with the very cold, very dense water underneath it. To make matters worse, hot water already holds less dissolved oxygen than colder water. This 1-2 punch means much less oxygen makes it into the ocean depths, and the OMZ gets beefed up accordingly. Then, on top of that, less available oxygen means marine bacteria breathe nitrate instead and produce nitrous oxide, a major greenhouse gas, which means things heat up a little more. You see where this is going. Obviously, none of this is great news for animals that, like us, prefer their oxygen in heaping portions. That includes most of the fish that you probably think of when I say the word fish. That is, the ones we eat. Tuna, sardines, hake. None of them can last long in the OMZ, so they simply avoid it. As the OMZ gets bigger, they get compressed into the thinning surface layer. It's a form of invisible habitat loss. Then again, animals that can handle the punishing conditions inside the zone are totally enthused. Jellyfish, comb jellies, the demonic umbrella we call the vampire squid. This is the moment that this much maligned group of low metabolic rate, detritus-eating weirdos has been waiting for. The ocean is their oyster. With apologies, I'm Max McClure for Cross Currents.
And the underwater sound that we used in that mix came from Laura Wehrmann-Linger, who is a member of freesound.org. Thank you. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Nina Gensler-Debs, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Sarah Reynolds, Laura Sapanara, Judy Silber, Ray Sue Sussman, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You'll find them online at citycarshare.org. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll meet the four high school girls behind the local band, The She's. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.